everyone, and welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
And I'm Dawn Keatley.
And in today's episode, we're kicking off the spooky season with Michael Dougherty's Trick or Treat. Told in an anthology format with non-linear storytelling, the film is a virtual shout-out to Halloween lore, making it a cult classic among many horror fans. But does it deserve its reputation? We're breaking it all down today with spoilers, so stay tuned. So what did y'all think about this one?
I love Trick or Treat. I do.
You do.
I do like these like anthology stories. I don't know. It just kind of brings me back to Creepshow. I enjoy that it's got a little tongue-in-cheekedness, if that's a real word.
It is now.
I like the characters. I like the stories. Yeah.
I did not like it.
Oh, wow. That came out of left field. I didn't expect that.
No, me either.
I kept silent about that until now. You've seen it before?
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen it before.
Okay. This was my first time watching it. And I didn't like it, which it's not terribly surprising since I'm not a fan of anthologies. Mm-hmm. The 80s is my least favorite horror decade. And this was, you know, people have talked about how it's a kind of back to the 80s of horror film. So I found it a little pointless, to be honest.
Well, there you go.
Boom. If there was a mic drop sound, we should insert it there.
That would be it. Yeah. Well, I liked it. I mean, I like that it's campy and it's low stakes and it's just kind of a fun movie. I will say I haven't watched it since its release in 2007. And wow, does it make some choices with regard to disability that I did not remember being as aggressive as they are. So that kind of took me out of the movie and hampered some of the fun. But I think overall, I still enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So just say something about the disability in this film.
You got a hard R in there.
Yeah, it is a hard R. So they use the word. The history of it is being used in relation to people, you know, with
intellectual disabilities.
Yeah.
And it was mostly in relation to the Halloween school bus massacre.
Mm-hmm. Oh, completely.
Oh, yeah.
In relation to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also the school bus, which we will get into.
That whole scene.
Gwen and I have actually talked about this, that we are amazed that that has not been written about in relation to disability.
It will be, you guys.
Yes, it will. But we are going to get there because Gwen has a lot of knowledge to drop on us. So we're going to break this anthology down story by story. And the first story involves Emma and Henry. Does anyone want to describe that?
I was thinking we could sort of, we don't want to leave that just to you, Liz.
Please.
We could take it in turns.
Thank you.
And I'll take the first one because it's kind of interesting in terms of its reference. It's simply a couple coming back from trick-or-treating, Emma and Henry. And Emma clearly did not have a good time when she was trick-or-treating. And then she tries to snuff out the candle in the jack-o'-lantern. And Henry's like, ooh, you don't want to do that. But she does. And then she's slaughtered. We don't know by whom.
Well, there you go.
The whole opening scene resonates with my favorite horror movie, which is 1978's Halloween. There's laundry type things like white sheets hanging, something mysterious sort of lurking on the other side of the white sheet. And there's point of view shots from across the road.
Great ones.
And doesn't she... She looks across the road and sees a figure in a white mask looking at her, just like Laurie Strode does in Halloween. So, you know, that kind of, that opens it. And then, and this is one of the things that is interesting about this anthology, all the different plots are interwoven. So we see them later on from a different perspective.
Which I like how they did that.
There's a couple times where you got to see
the same situation from a different perspective.
Exactly. Sometimes the scene gets replayed entirely from someone else's perspective. Sometimes main characters from one story just kind of drive or walk by in the background of another story. I do think we actually do see Emma and Henry walking down the main street of the town, I think, at one point, like later in the film. So that was, you know, obviously about when they were, you know, doing Halloween things before they get back home.
I mean, because this film is so much about playing with like Halloween traditions, I thought, I was like, okay, well, where does that idea of if you snuff out the jack-o'-lantern.
I've never heard of that before.
It came from Ireland.
Really?
So yeah. So in Ireland, there's something called Samhain. And it's interesting because the anglicized version of that would be Sam. So I think they pulled from that. But the whole idea is that past spirits dress in costumes so that they can walk among the living, and that the lit jack-o'-lanterns are what protects you. And so right out of the gate, it's sort of playing with a legend that most people probably wouldn't know, but that comes up again repeatedly in the film. So
yeah, it does.
It's a smarter film in that regard in terms of, okay, we're going to like engage with legends that might not be popular lore. I mean, it does get into like urban legends later on, which I think people are more familiar with.
They mention Celtic stuff, don't they, somewhere?
They do. Yeah. They do. So it's kind of like a nice nod to that, that I think in a lot of analysis of the film gets lost.
So don't snuff out the candles because they are what are protecting you from the dead.
But I also, I also love that she gets dismembered and her body parts get strung up the way the plastic body parts were in the yard beforehand. And I thought, wow, you know, if you really stop and think about the decorations were hanging, that's pretty aggressive.
Yeah. And her boyfriend doesn't even realize it at first when he sees her.
Typical.
Yeah.
He goes inside while she's doing the work and falls asleep watching porn.
So there's a couple of things I want to mention about this section. So one, I think you bring up a good point about Halloween. Throughout this film, I definitely saw a lot of nods to other horror films. Like I definitely felt I saw a lot of Halloween, a good amount of Pet Sematary.
Yes.
And several other ones. So I think we should kind of revisit that through each of the stories.
The Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Evil Dead comes up and The Thing.
Yeah. And then I think that this section is important less for the actual story, because this story was probably one of my least favorites in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it really just sets up this idea of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something, too, that I want to kind of talk about throughout, is why is tradition so important? Because I find it interesting that it's set in suburbia. There's a lot of talk about traditional roles, whether it's adult and child, parent and, you know, daughter, son. There's a lot of roles in there, but it seems to, you know, angel and devil.
That's a great point.
You know, and it even mentions like in that first scene, it's the night where evil roams free, which I find interesting. Okay, so what is evil? That's very subjective and it plays with our idea of tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says we can pretend to be the scariest thing that we can think of. But interestingly, you know, throughout these stories, which we'll mention, sometimes people dress as an angel. Is that the scariest thing? Sometimes people dress like their father. Is that the scariest thing? So it sets up this idea of tradition and norms and ritual. And, you know, what do we do with that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the only value I found really in that one.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to frame it, honestly.
I also think it's I read this article in Paste by Jim Varel from 2017, and he says the thing he likes about Trick or Treat is that it really venerates Halloween and its traditions, and that I think the opening is not an accident, because even though Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween, is the more famous, it's not actually really about Halloween. I mean, this guy kind of makes that point. Like, Trick or Treat is really about Halloween traditions, whereas, I mean, Halloween was originally called the Babysitter Murders. So, and that's more like what it is than Halloween. It's just kind of coincidentally set on Halloween.
And I mean, in Sam, too, we learn that we do have sort of the enforcer of those traditions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that holds up. Should we dive into story two? Sure.
Principal. It's called Principal?
Principal Wilkins. No. Okay, I'll take that one.
I wasn't mentally prepared to summarize these sections.
This is actually one of my favorite ones. So we start by, there's a kid, a Charlie. You see him walking down the street. He's just breaking all the pumpkins. He stumbles upon a house that says, you know, here's a candy jar, take one. Of course, he takes all of them, and he's caught by who we discover is Principal Wilkins. So the two sit down on the stoop, and, you know, they're going to have a little bit of heart-to-heart. Principal gives him a piece of candy. Lo and behold, the candy is poisoned, and in very grotesque fashion, we find Charlie is a goner. He starts vomiting everywhere.
Yeah.
He's dragged into the back. Principal Wilkins tries to bury him. He's interrupted by his son, who wants to carve a pumpkin, or that's what we think. All he says is, I want to do the carving now. Poor little Billy. So long story short, Billy and Daddy are going to carve something, but it's going to be the head of poor Charlie.
Charlie.
Yes. Yeah. So what did we think about this one? This was a lot.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand Charlie. He deserved everything he got. He was a bit of a twit.
I really had no problem with Charlie dying.
No, I didn't either.
But there's so much dark humor in this particular story, because as the principal's trying to bury him, there's another body in there that isn't completely dead. And so he's trying to kill him while also dealing with his neighbor, Mr. Krieg, and also dealing with his son who just is, you know, demanding. And there's this great sort of fake out scene of where you think that the dad is taking the knife because he's going to kill his son because he's such pain in the ass.
I wanted him to.
And I kind of felt him in that way. I was like, wow, that kid is obnoxious. Yeah. And he brings it down and it's into the head of Charlie.
I mean, maybe this is not the right question to ask, but I was like, why does he kill Charlie? Is it because, I mean, Principal Wilkins does say tradition, you've got to respect.
He didn't check his candy.
Right.
That's the rules. He didn't check his candy.
Yeah.
And he violated it.
Principal Wilkins is very into tradition and rules. And he's like, the traditions are here to protect us. So what? Charlie just didn't check his candy.
Yep.
So he deserves that? Okay.
He also tried to steal all the candy. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, his crimes are many.
and he was crushing pumpkins, smashing pumpkins.
He was not honoring the holiday.
Yeah.
I also love this section because it did have a lot of the nods to the 80s. Do you remember
going
door to door? They wanted you to take a UNICEF box. Like, who's
the
gonna,
details are so good.
Like, who's going to opt out of looking for candy? I would love to say I was philanthropic at that age. I was not. I wanted the candy. I didn't like the lady that gave me apples or pennies.
Right.
I didn't want to do the UNICEF box.
Oh, my gosh.
And that whole panic about razor blades in your candy at the time. Like, this was gold to me.
But I also like the added detail of it's the principal.
Yeah.
You know, the person who supposedly is entrusted with your children. It's such a, like...
It's the whole film, though.
It's, well, any authority figure is, like, re-envisioned or reimagined. But I would say that for all of the roles, it's kind of a different take.
You know, if you look at it on its surface, so again, in that first, you know, story that we had talked about, they said that it's the night where evil can roam free. Who's roaming free? The children.
Yeah.
That's who is taken over the streets. So are we, you know, positioned to think of children as evil? Even though Sam, we don't know what he is, what age he is, and he's kind of a policeman too. And then we think these adults are going to be policemen of evil. And my God, are we wrong on so many levels.
Yeah.
But I can't really get a good idea of, is there even any good in this film? Like, as far as if you just look at the dichotomy of good versus evil.
Yeah, no, there's
like,
not.
Like, no, there's not.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see any person, I guess the closest, and again, I'm jumping ahead, is maybe the werewolf and, and they're cannibals.
Yeah.
You know?
Or Rhonda.
Oh, yeah. Rhonda's pretty cool. Yeah. Rhonda's pretty cool.
But there is, like, in terms of tradition, I did like the way it's not only dealing with the Halloween tradition, but it's also showing a tradition between father and son.
Yeah.
I mean, they are carving. Good they point. Are engaging in sort of like this domestic activity. It just doesn't look like anything we would want people to be engaged in.
He passes on his lineage, almost like the movie Parents.
Yes.
Where it starts to replicate.
Which
later
is another,
on.
I think, intentional reference.
Yeah.
So what happens to Billy? Because obviously Mr. Wilkins, and this is when you said there's no good and evil. I mean, Mr. Wilkins in this story is defending Halloween traditions against a not very likable kid, but he gets his own comeuppance later, I guess, for killing Charlie. But then I forget what happens to Billy.
There's this
Isn't
great
he just standing there at some point
he's
near the end.
Sitting like on the stoop, and it kind of reminded me of like Michael Myers in Halloween, where you have that just sort of great look at like, okay, now we know what's gonna happen to this kid.
Yeah.
And it felt like sort of a nod to that.
But it's almost like he's rewarded because he's following the rules.
Right.
And so this is what your reward is? you become the alpha predator, maybe? And is that all we are, is just on a series of food chains?
Masculinity is a complicated thing, Gwen.
Yeah. Although they show the violence of women in that bullying one that comes up. What is that, next?
That's next.
Yeah, yeah. Halloween school bus massacre.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's the
one. This was the creepiest. This is the best one.
Yeah, this was probably my favorite.
This is also the most problematic one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, so problematic.
As horror should be. So that's probably in part why it was good.
Yeah.
Well, I thought about that because my reaction to hearing, if I read that in like a book produced in the 80s or the 70s, like, okay, it's of its time. But like 2007 feels like such a choice.
Yeah.
And
to use the R word.
To use the R word. And it did take me out of the film. But then I thought about it and I was like, well, there's also a case, I guess, to be made that horror is supposed to be transgressive. But it also doesn't feel transgressive given, like, in 2007, I think it was like 2005, that groups were asking Congress and the administration of the time to revisit the ADA because the Supreme Court had been going in and sort of been chipping away at it. So there was a dialogue happening in relation to the ADA, and it feels weird that the film would almost come down on the side of not the transgressive. Like, you're kind of siding with the dominant culture, which is moving away from...
Because that word is used? Because it seems to me the people who use it are completely punished.
The parents.
I feel like it had to be a cognizant choice on the part of the writer or director. Because I feel like we could have gotten the same point kind of across, even if we took out the intellectual delays. Like, we would have just talked about difficult children, behavioral children, challenging children. So there was a point in putting that in there somewhere, I think.
I think so. And I guess it bothered me that, like, you do the driver, who's the one who's going to actually kill the kids, and we'll backtrack, but was going to kill the kids. He does get his comeuppance, but the parents who paid him, all these parents, nothing happens
to
them.
They were, quote-unquote, unburdened.
I thought that was wild. But do you want to describe it, Gwen?
So it sounds like there's this story woven throughout the movie where in this town, you had a bunch of parents, and I think, in quote, it says, these parents became exhausted and embarrassed by their children. And we start to learn that these children have behavioral concerns, possibly some intellectual delays just because of the use of these terms, such as idiot savant and the hard R word. And they just didn't know what to do with them. And instead of seeking any other type of assistance, they kind of came up with a pact within themselves, with the town, with the principal, with the bus driver, where they basically paid the bus driver off to chain all the kids to the bus and drive off a cliff into a quarry. And so everybody, so we think, perishes. And so that's kind of the backstory. But in this little section in the film, we get this idea that, you know, kids dare each other to go to this quarry and, you know, go down this little mine shaft and you know, try to goad each other into, it's almost like stepping on the crazy lady's porch. It's like those neighborhood games that we have where we dare each other to do things. And then they go down there. And there's the threat that possibly the zombies or the bus children would come back and come to get you. So that's kind of what transpires. There's a couple of kids. I remember Macy's name. I remember Rhonda's name. I don't remember all the kids' names.
It was Chip, Schrader, and Sarah.
And isn't Mary the leader of the pack? She's the one that dresses like the...
Macy
is the leader of the pack. She dresses like an angel. She's kind of like the mean girl of the crew. She's like the Regina George of the crew. And they have this girl that's different, you know, and not in any way. She's just kind of like, she just maybe wouldn't have sat at their lunch table. And so they try to get her to come along with them just to goad her to going down in there pretending that they're going to be friends, right? And then they go down there and with the idea to kind of trick her into going into the zombies or getting taken over by the zombies, and then it fails. So you might have to help me fill in some of those gaps.
So once they go down to the quarry, Rhonda thinks that the zombies have come because they're playing a big practical joke. She falls and hurts herself. She realizes that it's not real. They wind up going back up because there's sort of like this lift that lifts you down and up into the quarry. And turns out the zombies are real and they're coming, and they first feast on Sarah. And as that's happening, they're running, and At this point, Rhonda has gotten into sort of the cage that's going to lift her up to safety, and they're begging to be let in, and she mm-hmm. won't let them. She just goes up instead, and then all you hear are the sounds of them getting consumed. But I wondered, something that you said made me think, I kind of assumed that Rhonda would have been on that bus.
Do you? Okay.
So I... Yeah. Yeah. You think that's right?
I mean, and the bus happened, and maybe this is the justification for the use of some of the language. I mean, it's a flashback to mm-hmm. 30 years ago when the kids are chained to the bus. So that yeah. would put it in the 80s, yeah. the much less politically correct 80s.
Oh, absolutely.
So
because everybody who does say it is completely confined,
from that time
isn't
period,
it?
I think. Unless I can't remember how the kids in the contemporary era talk about Rhonda.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
I think about Rhonda as socially awkward, maybe not intellectually or behaviorally challenged. She just was an awkward kid. But I guess, yeah, you could see her possibly being stereotyped.
Well, maybe that's all that got the kids yeah. chained up on the bus in the first place 30 oh, years yeah. ago. They mm-hmm. were just socially awkward. I mean, it's interesting because they're all wearing masks on the bus. It's a very creepy scene. They're all wearing masks. They're sitting all separately. They're chained. There's a way in which we, as the audience members, we really know nothing about them. I mean, they could be completely, quote, normal kids.
Yeah. See, I was just going to, as you were saying that, I wanted to say, like, so, okay, let's take the whole chaining children to buses out of the picture, because that's not appropriate on any level. So I'm not
we
for chaining
are in
children.
Agreement.
I feel like sometimes we have to say I'm not for yeah. this or that. But, you know, for a second, did you ever find your allegiance with the parents as they were telling the story? And I mean, they did, you know,
not
they
really.
Posited it against the parents. Because, yeah. again, I think the quote was, so everyday parents put their dirty little secrets yeah. on these buses. So, again, that reminded me of Pet Sematary, because she would talk about the dirty secret in the back room. But it's not that I find an allegiance, but in the 80s, I could see the amount of overwhelming feelings to a parent, because there was lack of services in many cases, and this frustration. Again, I'm not okay with sending kids off a cliff on a bus. But like,
I love that you have to reiterate that.
I'm trying to play around with, like, did they posit it? Like, did they ever, the way they told the story? Because especially making the kids look so weird and uncomfortable and, like, on the far end on that spectrum, were they trying to push us to understand why the parents felt that way? I don't know.
I mean, in a way, it kind of echoes Nightmare on Elm Street.
I was thinking that.
Oh, yeah. You have sort of the parents all coming together and making not great choices, to say the least, and having subsequent generations bear the brunt of that. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a little bit echoed in that.
But it's also like Michael Myers in Halloween. I mean, you reference Billy sort of is possibly evoking Michael Myers in that shot where he's sitting on the porch. I mean, all of those kids chained on the bus do evoke Michael Myers with his mask.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was in a mental institution and he escaped. I mean, that's a justification for what the parents are doing if these are all little Michael Myerses.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They should be locked up.
And we're trained to think people that look creepy in a mask in a horror film are the bad guys.
Right.
Well, they usually are.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So there's our own set of rules that we have in horror.
Yeah, that's true.
That does it play with
and the Michael Myers kind of reference really just amplifies that. That, yeah, someone creepy in a mask is equals evil, really.
That's really interesting because, I mean, it's definitely a section that plays with urban legends. And what is an urban legend if not a story that has been passed down where the truth has kind of been obfuscated, you know?
Yeah.
And you're not really getting the truth. You're getting a version. So
that's true. So we don't know if there's any truth to this story at all, actually.
No.
Like the story.
True.
Like the school bus is down there. So there was a school bus that went into the quarry.
And we know that Krieg was involved because he was
Krieg,
the bus driver.
He was the bus driver. But everything else about it could be just completely fabricated. And the shot of the children in the masks chained to the bus.
Mm-hmm.
Could just be how the story has evolved over 30 years.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just sometimes think about these things on grander scales, too, because Liz and I have obviously talked a lot about films with caregiving, and we've even just on the side talked about taboo things, and people like to brush over things in America and say, oh, that's just family. But again, I mean, did you ever think when you planned your child, this perfect child that you're going to hold in your arms, that's going to love you forever, and they're going to be so grateful, and, you know, all these amazing things that you picture in your head when you get married and you have that kid and you're raising them and you're doing everything right because, you know, Dr. Spock told you so. And this is what happens. And it's not that you don't love them, but you're literally never allowed to say I'm frustrated or overwhelmed. You're not. It is immediately shut down. And so sometimes I think about it, it's that part that goes over the edge of the quarry is you can't even talk about that frustration.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I know that's way too deep for this film because that would probably take a mother to write that film.
Yeah.
But it's just sometimes I think about that. Like we can't even say it.
I mean, honestly, that's what is great about horror is it does open up those types of cultural conversations. Yeah. And we had talked about how this movie is not written about, which absolutely blows my mind. Yeah. If you talk about disability, this movie's never referenced, at least that I've ever seen. And so I feel like what you've just said is a way to use the film to talk about disability and caregiving and the intersection between the two in a way that's actually really useful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love that idea of it. It's that those scenes sort of being a metaphor for the ways in which parents, I mean, and the masks really work there because they don't want to see their child. They don't want to see them as a human. Mm-hmm. They're just like, this is
the part of them. Yeah.
This is the part they can't deal with anymore that needs to go over into the quarry.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Into the swamp with you.
You know, this segment sort of reflects the history of horror in which bullies get their comeuppance. Mm-hmm. So you have like Henry and It, Brian and Cobwebs, but it's very rare that girls are included.
Yeah.
I'm talking like, you know, young girls are included. And this is one of the few films, I think, where we really get a solid girl who's a bully who gets her comeuppance. I mean, not even in The Bad Seed, which is kind of everyone's go-to, she doesn't get her comeuppance. Yeah. And
or orphan, and she's not even like a little girl. But sorry, guys, if you haven't seen that one.
Yeah, so in terms of bullies, it really is doing, it's reinventing in a way that I don't think it gets credit for either.
And she's so angelic looking. I mean, obviously she's dressed as an angel, but she looks angelic too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The one thing I did struggle with in this part is that Schrader demonstrates, like, he is the one who goes to Rhonda and is like, I'm so sorry, this was a joke. You know, he lets her cry on his shoulder. And then when it comes time to flee, she shows no mercy. She's like, I'm out of here. And I mean, it could have been like, if you let in him, you have to let in everybody. But I thought that was a pretty bold choice because we really are positioned to be identifying with Rhonda. And even though this person, you know, admitted they made a mistake and tried to make amends for it, it's too bad, so sad.
Although interestingly, though, a lot of times if a man or a male child would do that, we cheer him on. You know, but it's
kind of like that little part seemed to reference Carrie. I thought even the people who are sympathetic to Carrie in that, like the guy she goes to the prom with and Sue.
Yeah.
They get blown up with everyone else.
Oh, spoiler again. Sorry, guys. We're ruining them all.
Yeah. It's true, though, because doesn't what starts off the zombies rising up? It's when she kicks the lit jack-o'-lantern in it and extinguishes it. So it really was the violation of tradition, again, that sort of set things in motion instead of it being a straight bully situation.
I think I had the rules
well,
written
that,
down somewhere.
That was the main one. That was the one that seemed to precipitate the most violence.
Always wear a costume.
Mm-hmm.
Always hand out candy.
Yes.
Never blow out a jack-o'-lantern before midnight and respect the dead. Yeah. But in there, too, was always check your candy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think that those were the main ones.
Not really respecting the dead either, maybe.
True.
She's exploiting the dead to play basically a mean trick on somebody.
And that is how she gets Rhonda to come, is that they're going to, like, bring pumpkins for each one of the dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Kids.
They're going to honor the dead, but then they're actually not, so... Yeah, she deserves it.
That's true.
So, okay,
sorry,
Surprise
Rhonda.
Party was not one of my favorites. I mean, Surprise Party is just about four girls who turn into vampires, werewolves. What are they?
Werewolves,
werewolves?
I think.
Werewolves. Okay. Yeah, it's like Little Red Riding Hood, though, in some ways.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Inversion of Little Red Riding Hood. Yeah, there are four girls, and one of them is a, quote, virgin. Little Red Riding Hood. Anna Paquin, I think I'm saying her name right. She subsequently became pretty famous. She was in HBO's True Blood. Mm-hmm. I think that's HBO. Apparently, she was one of the reasons why this film has developed a kind of cult following. But it's fairly, I don't know, just they go to a party and she turns into a werewolf.
Oh, I liked this one.
Okay, am
I
the sorry. Only one?
Yeah, because I felt like it was, you would kind of expect it to be a Mean Girls situation because it starts with them like trying on their outfits.
Yeah.
And her sister.
Well, they were mean girls.
Well, I think they were more.
They were mean to Little Red Riding Hood.
I don't think so. I think the ending sort of rechanged or recontextualized how I saw that. Like, at first, I was like, yeah, they're just like giving her grief.
It's like Hell Night in a sorority. It's like, we're going to give you a little bit of crap, and then we're going to initiate you, and then welcome. Yeah. Like, flick on the lights.
Yeah, it was an initiation.
Yeah.
And there's also like a subplot, too, that we see there's a masked.
Yes.
Killer on the loose, and he has a propensity for like biting. So we think it's like a vampire kind of situation. And we find out that it is Principal Wilkins, which was so obvious.
Yeah.
Like from the jump, I'm like, you could have gave a better mask or something.
Yeah.
But he winds up, you see him go after Lori, who is the one dressed as Little Red Riding Hood. And the big reveal is that he is now tied up and he's about to be consumed. And she turns into a werewolf and you see the great shots of like the back. It was very much like The Fly in that you got like a lot of the body shots.
Yeah.
That I think are a lot of fun. So you guys weren't a fan of this one.
I found its greatest value just as a vehicle for the Principal Wilkins kind of narrative.
Yeah, I think without him being like sort of their main victim, it would have fallen flat.
You know, it's a twist on the male predator comeuppance thing because he does, he kills a girl slightly earlier in the segment. And then, you know, obviously he's getting his comeuppance.
And I think it plays too like that whole idea of like adolescent females as sort of like stalking their victims definitely gave... Well, with the movie Ginger Snaps.
Yeah.
It felt very Ginger Snaps to me. Yeah. So I think that's another movie reference that's happening.
And Jennifer's Body, though. Yeah. I think this is before Jennifer's Body. I can't remember now.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it is. Yeah, that's it like is, from 2009. So, yeah.
So do you think there's anything that they were doing specifically by picking Little Red Riding Hood? Do you think it's sort of more those like traditional stories that were told? Only reframing him.
But yeah, again, I think it just plays with tradition and roles.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, it's, you know, you think that Little Red Riding Hood is going to be a victim, even in the regular story.
Mm-hmm.
And then it plays out a little bit differently. We think she's going to be a bad girl. Like some of them are going to be bad girls. We think that she's going to be a good girl. Like we think that principals are good. We think that adults are good. Like, so it really just kind of... Yeah. Played a lot with ideas of right, wrong, good, bad, authority, and all that.
And I think the four main girls in this story, don't they all play princesses that are saved by men at the end? I mean, there's Red Riding Hood, Snow White, Cinderella, and The other one is probably the girl from Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, Aurora.
Why do
I know her?
Aurora.
I mean, they're all saved by men. That's the trajectory of their story. And it's completely inverted here. They don't need to be saved by men. They're going to eat men.
That's right.
Yeah. It's definitely appropriate that Little Red Riding Hood is the one that turns into the wolf where, you know, normally she's the one threatened by the wolf in the woods. And they are in the woods when they have the party.
And I like that they entice their victims by sort of playing the damsel in distress. So each one of the girls has to bring a man back. And you think, oh, you know, they're just looking to hook up. When in reality, then you see all their dead bodies. I was like, wow, that was great.
Yeah, it plays with the idea of female victimhood. Because even the film itself, Emma's the only woman.
Well,
and Macy, I guess.
Oh, and Macy.
But she deserves every minute of it.
Her friend, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the final story. Krieg versus Sam.
Yeah.
I think this is the best part of the movie.
Really?
Yeah. You don't? Huh. Wow. No, it was a lot.
It gave me flashbacks to the movie Trainspotting when the baby's climbing all over the ceiling. When the guy's trying to get clean from heroin and he starts hallucinating.
I know that scene well.
I see Sam climbing on the walls and I'm like, that just makes me feel like Krieg is withdrawing. I don't know.
Well, I thought it was fun that the movie tried to play with sort of nonlinear storytelling. So if you go back to the Principal Wilkins, there was sort of an exchange with him. And now we're seeing it from the perspective of Cregan.
Yeah, Krieg is an older man who turns out to have been Principal Wilkins' neighbor. And so when Wilkins was trying to bury Charlie in the backyard, his neighbor yells to him, "What are you doing?" And it turns out that's Krieg. And that's the scene that we see repeated almost entirely from Krieg's perspective in this last segment. And he also turns out to be the bus driver from Halloween School Massacre. So he's kind of threaded through all of the segments. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's in Surprise Party with the four werewolves, but...
But he has a werewolf costume on his dog.
That's right. Spite, which is a great name.
That is a connection. So it makes sense that he ends up in this sort of battle with Sam, the sort of iconic little monster of this film, since they're the two that do kind of appear in every segment in some way. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's finally sort of the spirit of Halloween, the essence of Halloween versus this old man who just, this curmudgeonly old man who hates everything about Halloween.
And it takes him like a violent exchange that goes on and on to realize that all Sam wants is, you have to give me a piece of candy. Because it's trick or
treat. You always have to hand out candy.
Yeah. And so when
he stole the kids' candy, too.
Yes, yes. And when he accidentally gives Sam the candy, it stops his sort of reign of terror. But there's a great scene where, and this was so Pet Sematary, he's under the bed and he cuts his Achilles.
Totally Pet Sematary.
It's 1,000%. And I was like, well, that's a great nod there.
Yeah. And Sam is kind of like Gage.
He absolutely is.
Oh, yeah. Costume.
I had him right there.
Like him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh. But it kind of plays with the idea of what is a child, too, because it's like Sam kind of teeters this line because he's obviously ancient in some ways. He's childlike in others. You don't really know what he is.
Yeah.
He's alive and dead. He's young. He's old. He's everything. I don't know.
Well, he is the spirit of Halloween.
Yeah.
And so he's like an evil spirit as well as a child. Both of them together.
What I wanted to know was, did he let him, Krieg, live because he'd fulfilled the spirit of Halloween or because it wasn't his score to settle? Because there's also the scene where, like, the very ending scene is where, like, all the zombies from the bus accident sort of descend on Krieg's house.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't sure the exact reason why he let him live.
I mean, I guess...
He gave him candy.
Yeah, so, I was just going to say, if you're talking about rules and tradition and we're sticking to that, if he really polices the spirit of Halloween...
Then it is the candy.
Then it's fulfilled.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So then I think it's like, okay, exactly what you said. It's, I have nothing to do with that because I only deal in the realm of Halloween. So let's let these guys handle stuff that was non-Halloween.
Yeah, I would buy that. So does this qualify as revenge horror?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's... Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
that story kind of comes throughout. Yeah.
Yeah.
Valid.
Yeah. Infractions are punished.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the main things I think here.
There's a lot of seeking of vengeance in different characters that I think kind of gets obscured by the humor. Because this is a film that definitely tries to have as many comedic moments as scary moments, I think.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Burying the kid in the backyard and your head popping up. And
I did not find it funny.
You didn't find any of the dark humor? No.
I find it funny once.
I laughed when Sam and Krieg were like fighting and then... Nothing.
No. Nope.
Call Me Hard just is not for you.
It's really not. And that last segment has been compared to Evil Dead 2. And obviously there's the hand. And, you know, I appreciated when the hand, Sam's hand, was crawling across the floor. And I think Krieg says, "You've got to be fucking kidding me." Which is the reference to the thing.
That's so funny. No?
It is.
That's not even funny anymore. Sorry. But I've just never found Evil Dead funny. I don't get it. So
I think we're going to have like a live Twitter watch where it's not even, we're not even watching a film. We're watching Dawn watch a horror comedy.
Oh okay. My God. That would be amazing.
I'll be stone faced.
I would and pay to watch that. That would be amazing. Yeah. Well, but you might, so you didn't like the folklore aspect of it. I'm trying to work so hard to find something.
I thought that was interesting, yeah.
Yeah, that's all you're getting.
This is not a favorite.
It was a little thin. So, okay, someone snuffs out a candle and they're killed. I mean, yeah.
Can't have a more ringing endorsement than that.
I mean, my favorite, honestly, like the only part that really stayed with me and resonated was the scene of the kids in the school bus with the masks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very creepy.
Me too.
But notice that wasn't funny.
Like, no.
No.
That
not
was
at all.
My favorite part, and it
That's
wasn't.
True.
That makes sense.
It wasn't being played for laughs in any way, shape, or form.
Well, so. We were talking before the podcast began about, like, why is this movie considered, like, a cult classic? Because it,
no idea.
I don't know either, because, I mean, it's not doing anything, like, super unusual or super wild.
Or new.
No. I mean, we just went through all the films that it references.
I think one reason has just got to be its evocation of the 1980s for people in 2007, 2009. I mean, I guess it's that kind of retro appeal, especially the appeal of the 80s, which seems huge.
Yeah.
Though I guess the 90s are
also have you seen
huge.
All these kids wearing band t-shirts that you know that they've never listened to like a Cinderella song? And you're like, oh, nice Cinderella shirt. Like, I think they did a good job with Sam. He's not scary. He's not scary, but what a great representation of Halloween. Like, you see Sam, even if you've never seen horror, even if you've never seen, you know, any of these types of things, you're like, oh, that's definitely fall and Halloween. I get it. He's got a big dome that looks like a pumpkin, and he's kind of creepy and silent, and he's just kind of cool. So I think that was smart that they wove him through, and he's definitely easy to merchandise.
I think it has to be the merchandising, right? Because
it's everywhere.
I would not have watched – well, I did not watch this movie in 2007 and thought, okay, Sam is going to be this breakout character who's I'm going to be talking about in 2023, right? So it would be interesting to go back and, like, look at how the merchandising worked with that, like – if it was a merchandising and then the film kind of followed, which sometimes happens, or if it was really based on audience reaction and desire to have more Sam merchandise.
Because if I was going to go cult classic, I would go Student Bodies. Like, Malvert is, like, I think about Malvert. I actually was in a Sheetz in West Virginia on the border of, like, Maryland, and I saw a guy that looked just like Malvert. And in my head, I'm quoting the film. I know that nobody around me has probably seen it, but to me, that's cult classic. But it
not
merchandised.
No, no. And I don't even know how you would merchandise that one.
Horsehead bookends.
I would 1,000% buy that.
Absolutely.
Can I just say, I know you don't probably ever want to do a horror comedy like ever again, but can I just say that movie, I still laugh when they kill the fly and they put 6.5 because they do a ticking of each murder.
Oh, yeah.
And he kills a fly and it turns to 6.5. That gets me every time.
It's got ringing of the criminologist from Rocky Horror Picture Show. Like,
it's everything.
It is gold.
I can't imagine laughing at any of that.
Oh, it's gold.
We won't make you.
No, we won't. So we'll save you that one.
But y'all out there should watch it.
So we have 80s throwback, the merchandising of Sam. That's distressing, if that's why. And there was actually, Michael Dougherty did a there's never been a sequel, which is strange.
I heard it's in the making now.
Yeah. I mean, there's rumors. I feel like they've been around for a while.
That's true.
Michael Dougherty did do a comic book in 2015, Trick or Treat, Days of the Dead, with four stories. That became a New York Times bestseller.
Oh, get out of here.
Nope. According to Wikipedia. So, and then the semi-famous people who became more famous. Oh, I read that somebody said it just encapsulates the spirit of Halloween. Like the scenery, the streets, the leaves, the lighting, and, you know, the pumpkins, the decorations, the costumes.
Yeah.
That it's more than any other film.
I think it's actually going to be on AMC next week for anybody that.
That makes sense. And that would be interesting, too, because I'm going to try to peer pressure you guys to do Dark Harvest next. And there's some overlap in terms of the setting and the character. So it would be interesting to look at the reception for that as well as this one.
Dark Harvest could become the new Halloween. Because what other films are there that sort of epitomize Halloween this season? I mean, there's obviously Halloween, but, you know,
Charlie Brown and the Great Pumpkin.
That's not horror.
Not horror.
It is to Gwen.
Yeah, I don't know. Offhand.
People are screaming at us titles right now saying, what are you doing?
I mean, and obviously the Halloween films do a little bit, you know, just, I mean, there are these brief moments in the first Halloween. Mostly I'm just thinking of one moment when Laurie's going into her house and the, you know, dry leaves are blowing along the street and she sees kids in Halloween costumes screaming and running up to a house and the jack-o'-lantern.
Boogeyman.
I think far more common is just sort of that September return to school, crunchy leaves than it is specifically Halloween.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're looking forward to Dark Harvest then, just to sort of go back to what Liz just said. A great book by Norman Partridge.
But I also wanted to bring everyone's attention to, and I will post this in the show notes, Dawn wrote a piece on trick-or-treating in Halloween movies in 2016.
Did I write that?
You wrote that.
Okay.
That's the best part of the website is we never remember what we wrote. But yeah, so I think it's an interesting framing of, like, if you want to consider trick-or-treating and tradition, it's definitely a piece to check out. Any other comments about trick-or-treat?
I guess we'll wait for the sequel. see if that's funny.
Well, I think you've just heard our final horror comedy podcast ever. But anyway, we will be back soon. Hopefully we'll do Dark Harvest. That's my hope.
Yep.
And you know where you can find us, all things social media. And in the meantime, we will talk to you later.
Bye.